Session number 12371, and this is reel number 16.
The next operation, really, major operation in which we were involved, was when the Germans launched their attack through the Ardennes. The American 9th Army in the north was put under command of General Montgomery. And of course, as we all know, the weather was very bad at the time, which was one of the reasons the Germans chose to launch the attack, because it blunted our air operations. But eventually, when the weather cleared, my wing was allocated duties in support of the American 9th Army. The first thing they did was to shoot down one of my flight commanders. But most of the operations we carried out were against rather thin air attacks. And here I collected a second claim against a jet. I was leading the wing over Liège when we suddenly saw a 234 jet unload a parcel of these anti-personnel bombs on Liège. I immediately launched an attack with my number two. He saw us coming and set off for Germany. Again, I managed to get up to close on to 500 miles an hour. And initially, I was just able to hold him. And then it was clear that he was going to get away, and I opened fire and saw strikes near the wing route of his aircraft, and then gradually he started to draw away, and nothing I could do would get me any nearer to him, and we were going further and further into Germany, and it just didn't seem worthwhile carrying on because I wasn't sure how far he could go. One of the tactics with these things, of course, was if you followed them long enough, they were going to run out of fuel. But I wasn't too sure about this type of aircraft, how much fuel he carried, and so I gave up the attack and claimed the damage when I got back to base. Shortly after this, I was sent some anti-glare spectacles, which I was asked to test. Well, I was also testing my own aircraft, which had just been in to be serviced. And so I took off by myself, keeping well behind the line, so that I could, A, test my aircraft to see if it was all right for operations, and B, give these anti-glare spectacles a test. All of a sudden, when I was at 18,000 feet, I saw a 262 just below me. I went to full throttle into the dive, and I was able to hold on to him for a bit. I opened fire without any apparent results, but I was beginning to close on him. I don't think he realised at that time I was there. And I opened fire again, and quite a large piece came off the aircraft, which then flicked over on its back and disappeared into cloud. When I got back to base, I claimed this as a probable, but subsequently it was confirmed as having been destroyed. We then came to what was the last major operation in which I had any participation during the war. And this was the attack by the Luftwaffe on the 1st of January 1945 on all our forward airfields, both British and American. This was probably a well-planned attack, but unfortunately, many of those participating were inexperienced. I won't go into the full details, it's been written up, I know, in several books. But the German plan, very briefly, was for the main force of fighters led by bomber navigators, in other words, bomber aircraft that were going to navigate the force. They were going to fly round the middle part of Holland and come in from the rear and attack us from the rear. Now, Volkel, as I've explained, was not only very close to the front line, but was covered with aircraft. No more attractive target could there have been, and no easier one to find. And yet the most extraordinary thing about it was they missed it. They didn't completely miss it, but they virtually missed it. I myself was airborne when the attack took place and was somewhere in the Osnabrück area leading one of my squadrons on an armed recce. And by the time I got back, it was all over. I did hear over the radio that something was going on. But, as I say, by the time we got back, the attack was virtually over. Casualties both in aircraft and personnel on both sides were high. But the significant difference was that whereas we could replace ours, the Germans couldn't. And so that attack on the 1st of January 1945 virtually ended the Luftwaffe's role in the Second World War. That is really with one exception, and that was the defense raised particularly against the United States daylight bombing attacks by pilots flying the Messerschmitt 262. This is all clearly documented in a book written by John Foreman and S.E. Harvey called The Messerschmitt Combat Diary, ME-262. A As I said before, the performance of these jets far exceeded anything that even our best fighters could achieve. When I have been at Manston with our Tempest wing, one of the squadrons that shared the airfield with me was our first Meteor squadron, which was of course the first jet squadron that we had in the Air Force. And one had witnessed the troubles they were having and rather assumed that the Germans were having the same trouble with their jet aircraft. However, the combats that we'd already had with them indicated that they seemed to be further ahead than we were and were enjoying rather more success. The German fighter pilots, particularly the senior fighter pilots, their aces all banded together, and they formed a wing of these 262s and combated the American bombers, and also, of course, the enormous fighter escorts that the Americans were now able to give to their bomber aircraft. Clearly, because these 262s were attacking bombers, the American fighters had a much better chance of attacking the 262s than we had had in the north, where we were simply coming across them on an ad hoc basis. But the determination shown by the pilots in the 262s was such that even when the Americans were able to devise tactics that were moderately successful, the determination of these very highly qualified German pilots was such that they very nearly brought the bomber offensive to a temporary halt. Even if one of them was shot down, he'd be back at the airfield and he'd be back into another aircraft and up in the air again. They were, of course, using rockets as offensive weapons, which were, I believe, modestly successful because it was a new weapon and they obviously had their degree of failures. But there's no doubt about it that that particular phase towards the end of the war was a brief resurgence of the Luftwaffe in this new aircraft. And had they have had more fuel and more ammunition and more aeroplanes, they could well have proved quite a stumbling block. As it was, of course, the casualties, lack of spares, lack of fuel, lack of replacement aircraft gradually wore them down, and so that was that. I was returned to England to reopen a Typhoon Tempest OTU because all the planning had been based on the fact that the war would probably finish in the autumn of 1944. Many of our operational training units are being closed down, and the casualty rate, particularly amongst Typhoon pilots, had been very high. And so we suddenly had to reopen two operational training units to provide enough Typhoon and Tempest pilots to allow us to finish the war. In April 1945, I decided to go back to Germany for one last fling and I flew out to Quackenbrook, where one of my old squadrons was based. By now, 122 wing had been split into two. And I flew on three operations with them. The whole scene had completely changed. When I left, Germans were extremely difficult to find. Now they were all over the place. You'd scarcely be airborne 5 minutes before you'd be set upon. And during the three sorties I went on, we lost at least four aircraft. And that was the last operation that I took part in World War II.
Why were they so numerous then? Because they were in a more concentrated area?
They were numerous because that's what was left of the Luftwaffe. They were fighting for their own country, over their own country. And this was a desperate man with desperate measures. As simple as that.
Where is Quackenbrook?
Quackenbrook is on the Dutch-German border.
And what type of things were they throwing up in those last three operations?
Oh, the aircraft scene were 190s and 109s. I might say, incidentally, that the wing commander who succeeded me as wing leader of 122 Wing, Peter Brooker, a highly experienced fighter pilot, lasted only about 2 months before he was shot down.
So it was a particularly hazardous period.
It was at that particular time. It was the end when the Germans were obviously using desperation measures. And the casualty rate went up quite considerably.
Going on to the post-war period, I think that you had a posting to what we now call Israel, or what was then called Palestine, in the few years immediately after the end of the Second World War.
No, I was in fact posted to originally to Middle East Air Forces, which was based in Egypt, but as with the Middle East Command, controlled not only the whole of the Middle East as we know it, that is Palestine, Jordan, Iraq, the crucial states, the Oman, Aden, East Africa, the Sudan, North Africa, Italy, Malta, and Greece. Palestine was just one element of the command. The only thing about it was that Palestine was, in fact, the key to the defence of the Middle East at that time, because the threat to the Middle East was now going to be from the Russians, who could be expected to come through what is now called Iran. And the Palestine was the only place that offered the geographical defences that would allow us to mount a defence line, because between there and Iran was just desert. Moreover, it meant that the Russians would be operating on very long lines of very vulnerable communications across the desert. And therefore, Palestine was regarded as an important feature in the defence of the Middle East, bearing in mind that one of our concerns at that time was not only the loss of the Suez Canal, which was still an important factor in our communications between United Kingdom and large parts of what was left of the British Empire, but also, once across the canal, the Russians could stream into Africa. And so Egypt as the main base and Palestine as virtually the main defence line were keys to the defence of the Middle East against the Russian threat.
You were a group captain then, were you?
No, I was a wing commander then. I served originally in Middle East headquarters, which was originally in Cairo, until we moved down to Canal Zone under the terms of the 1936 treaty. While I was in Cairo, we had a commitment down in the Gulf, the Persian Gulf, and this was a commitment that was in defence of British oil interests in Persia, as it was then called. There was a gentleman called Mossadegh, who was a leftward-leaning politician who was anxious to get us out of Persia and was causing a certain amount of trouble. We had a lot of British personnel, both men and families, deployed in the oil fields in Persia at the time, and clearly their safety was of concern to us. And so we alerted a British Army division, 3 division, which was in Egypt at the time, to be ready to deploy down in the Gulf in the event of trouble in Persia. I was attached to 3 division as the general's air liaison officer. However, there was a considerable concern about 3 division because, like so many of the British forces after the war, all the old sweats are gone and were being replaced by young, green and untried troops. And it was felt that these troops might have considerable problems operating in the enormous heat that existed down in the Gulf, particularly at that time of the year, because we're now talking about August, September 1946. And so it was decided to raise a force of Indian Army troops, which was named Force 401. And this force was a brigade group, which was redeployed from India into the areas of Margil, which is at the head of the Persian Gulf, near Basra. And so I was switched from Qasr Sin with 3 division down to the Persian Gulf. My task, of course, was to work out how we were going to get into the various, particularly mountain airfields in Persia, and how many sorties we're going to need of transport aircraft, and very importantly, how we were going to get out again, because some of these airfields were very small, and whilst it was one thing to get in with an empty Dakota, it was another thing to get out with a full one. Well, we have very little information on this particular subject. And it was then I discovered something that was no more than just luck. And that was that the chief pilot of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company was an old friend of mine from the Air Force. In fact, it's perhaps amusing at this stage to say that we were together in Scotland at one time, the time I referred to when I was doing my rest period up in Scotland. We were up there together. And I remember three of us were sitting in the office one day, and this chap, Ted Wolfe, was one of us. And he was a very good-looking fellow. He was also a very fine athlete, having been an RAF champion before the war. And we were all talking about what we were going to do when the war was over, and Ted said he was going to be a film star, and we all roared and laughed and thought it was very funny. But he used to, whenever he was able to get any time off at all, which obviously was pretty rare in those days, he used to go down to Elstree and stand in as a supporting actor. So he made up his mind to be a film star. But he didn't become a film star. He became the chief pilot of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, which was much more fortunate considering the circumstances in which I found myself. I managed to contact him, and he flew into Shaiba, which was one of our main airfields in Iraq at that time, in that part of the world. And I explained to him my problem. And he said, look, I'll give you all the details of all the airfields, and moreover, he said, I'll fly around all of them. So quite unofficially, I was in civilian clothes. I was flown around all these airfields in Persia so that I was able to see them and to see the problems, particularly getting out of them. That was the biggest problem, was getting out with a load. Some of them were fairly high up as well. And Ted was able to give me all the dimensions of the runways and things like that. And his help was enormous. We did do one little sortie across the Shatt al-Arab to Awaz, which is a town on the other side of the Shatt al-Arab, to do a reconnaissance over there. But that was about the only incursion we made into Persia, as it was called then. And then the whole political situation died down, and Force 401 was broken up, and we all returned to from whence we came.
So that must have been about 46.
1946, yes, around about August, September, July, August, September, that sort of period. And I returned to Cairo. Then we moved down to the Canal Zone, and we used to make visits to Palestine, as it was called in those days, which was a very unpleasant place to be, because not only were the Jewish terrorists attacking the Arabs, but they were attacking us. And the Arabs were not only attacking the Jewish terrorists, but they were also attacking us. So we were being assailed on all sides.